Scott, I see you there with my Ultra Running magazine.
It's the latest issue, the August 2017. Do you know who that is on the cover?
Well, I think that's the female winner of the race.
Do you know who that is?
Kat Bradley.
You are correct. Ultra Running magazine is one of my favorites because you can learn so much and you can see some of the race results. You get to find new gear. We're gear junkies,
yes.
And we love to look in there. Oh, that's a new piece of gear that we got to have. Save our money.
Yeah.
But there's a couple cool articles that just caught my eye in this month's issue. One is by one of our favorite guests, Ann Trason.
Ah.
And you're going to love the title of this article.
What is it?
Manage the Mind.
Ooh, she's good about that.
This is. And it's she gets some of her topics from people that write in and mm-hmm. ask her questions. And I
sure.
think that's absolutely going to be a good one. The other one that caught my eye, I had to chuckle a little bit, like a teenage or 12-year-old young man. It's called Preventing Runner's Trots. And I'm sure that I have no idea what it's about. But
you laughed. You had an idea.
It has a picture, a cartoon of a guy running with fire coming out of his butt. It's written by Sarah Kozik. And there's just article of after article, adjusting poles to benefit your
trekking
poles. Trekking poles. Yep.
And that's a hot topic these days.
It is.
Trekking poles. And Scott, I didn't even realize there were words in that Ultra Running magazine because the pictures are so fun to look at.
They are. Now, here's what you get if you're a Nation member.
Ready?
If you go to our partners page at trailrunnernation.com and you click on the link for Ultra Running magazine, you get 25% off the current subscription prices. You get 1 year for $29.95.
Simply go to Trail Runner Nation, go to the partners page and click on the link and bam, you're right over to Ultra Running Magazine. Scott Ward, you have life insurance.
I do. But you know the way that I got it?
How?
It was probably the way a lot of people got it. I got online and searched for life insurance A-rated companies and I went to two or three and had them bid me a quote.
Sure.
But they had no idea whether I was a runner or not, or whether I was in shape, or whether I sat on the couch and watched cartoons.
Right.
That's what Health IQ has done to revolutionize life insurance. What they do is they get with the A-rated companies, the ones that you want to be with anyway, and they've said, we have a pool of people that are living a healthy lifestyle and working at it. Let's give them a better rate.
You know what? That's just a good, good business model, Scott.
For everyone.
If you've got to bring together and reduce risk, just get the healthy people together and form a group, a tribe, if you will.
If you go to healthiq.com/TRN, you can find out more information and get a quote for your healthy lifestyle. But more importantly,
it's time for the quiz.
We look forward to this.
We need some background. I'm going to put some background music behind us. Go ahead, Scott. There'll be some music embedded in the background.
Some game show music?
Some game show music.
All right.
I'll surprise you.
So here we go. This one today is endurance sports, healthy ways to manage pain.
Ooh,
we should do a podcast on that.
We have.
Okay, are you ready?
I'm
going to click go, and I'm going to hit the start quiz button. Here's the first question. Massages directly following a long race have been shown to eliminate what?
Everything.
A, muscle swelling.
Yes.
B, pain, soreness in muscles.
Yes.
C, physiological muscle tears.
No.
D, protein levels.
No.
Which one? Muscle swelling? Pain, soreness in muscles.
Pain, soreness in muscles.
Okay. And you are correct.
Good.
Massages directly following difficult endurance events don't show strong ability to change physiology like muscle swelling, but they do relieve pain. Ready?
Yep.
Number two.
So I got that one right.
You did.
Just for the record.
Number two, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, which we've just talked about, NSAIDs, are pain relievers that can cause what complications for endurance athletes?
We know this because we did a podcast. You know what? We're like overhydration. No.
Kidney damage.
Yes.
Bing, 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 bing. Loss of vision acuity or preeclampsia.
Preeclampsia. So, Scott, when you went ding, 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 that made it pretty easy. I would say that is the correct
kidney
one.
Kidney damage.
Good.
We know all about that because we did a podcast on it recently. Third and final question.
I'm two for two.
And the final question.
Final.
Which pain reliever can be safe to take for a big event like a long race, but shouldn't be used during regular practice? A, alcohol.
Yeah.
B, electrolytes. C, Tylenol.
That's the answer.
D, water.
It's Tylenol, yep.
As a matter of fact, you're correct. Tylenol or acetaminophen can help an endurance athlete get through a long race, but regular use can result in liver damage over time, so use sparingly.
That's right. You know, there's no free lunch out there. You're always giving up something.
Health IQ is passionate about keeping us healthy, and they're passionate about putting A-rated life insurance companies in touch with those who are in shape, give them good rates, and let's all live a long and healthy life.
Where do you go to learn more about this, Scott?
You go to healthiq.com/giveittome.
TRN. I think that stands for Trail Runner Nation, Scott.
It does. Yeah. It's short.
I just love this whole Trail Runner Nation thing, right? Trail running. I think
the
it's
community.
Great.
It's a tribe.
It is a tribe. But
it's a community.
But sometimes we talk a lot about running 100 miles or even greater or 50 miles, like it's a mandatory to go out long, but it's not. You could still be a member of this tribe with shorter races.
And Under Armour has done a really good job of including everyone in their Under Armour Mountain Running Series. The final race of the season is coming up on September 8th through the 10th, and it is in Copper Mountain, Colorado. They have multiple distances from a 50K, that's the longest.
Right.
They have some marathon distances. If you can run the marathon, great. If you want to run the marathon with your friends, there's a marathon relay. There's
that's
a
fun.
Half marathon. There's a vertical challenge. Those are kind of fun. Yeah, there's a 10K. There's even a 5K that you can go run.
Is there a 5K relay?
You know what? Maybe they'll add that next year in their series. But no, there's just a 5K.
Got it.
You have to run that one all by yourself. Or with a friend if you register together.
Sure.
If you're interested in going to enjoy a festival of ultra-running community people on September 8th through the 10th, go to uamountainrunning.com and enter the code TRNATION, and you can get a 20% off discount when you register for that race.
Ladies and gentlemen of the wide, worldwide ultra-running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
The problem with the message above is that it flies in the face of what we know to be true.
We'll Candace, we are such idiots. You don't even you have no idea.
No, I've listened to your podcast for many years, and it's yeah. Yeah.
Frank. Yeah, yeah. I do own my own bar. every Friday morning on I Run Far, we open up and open up the taps.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything.
Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott Warr.
I'm Don Freeman.
Bob Crowley.
Candace Burt.
Scott, what brings us here today?
All of these people have something in common.
Well, we're all in the podcast?
We're all in a podcast, and all of them, all of us, have been involved in some way or another in different roles to a 200-mile race.
Of course, Candace, the infamous race director, the visionary behind these races, not only Tahoe 200, Bigfoot 200, but now Moab 200.
And let's go back. Is Bigfoot 200 this year was a third annual running? So you started back in 2015. No, 2014, 15.
15.
This, 2015.
Yep, 2015.
We can edit that out. And was that the first 200-mile race in the United States that you know of?
Are we talking about Tahoe? Sorry, that was 2014.
No. Tahoe was the first 200?
Yes. Yes, Tahoe was the first one that I created.
Okay, and was that the first 200 in the United States?
No, there's sort of, you got to make the distinction that it was the first non-repetitive 200, so the first 200-miler that was created that you're not doing 10 or 20-mile loops around, you know, like a water treatment facility or, you know, whatever it is that, there have been 200s out there, but they're usually like repetitive or they're all repetitive loop kind of courses. So Tahoe is the first one where every step is unique and you're going out and exploring new terrain the whole way. So it's 205 miles of non-repetitive trail.
It's one large loop.
One huge loop. Yeah, exactly.
One 200 and how many miles, Don?
200 and what? Tahoe? 205 miles. And I appreciated every one of those last five. I appreciate that, Candace. And I'm looking forward to finding a race that runs around a septic system there. What did you call that? A water treatment
facility.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There is one in Washington that it's called the Pigtails 200.
So let me introduce the roles of the people that are here. Scott was very generous to be my crew out there. I was going to go out
at Bigfoot 200.
At Bigfoot 200, and I was going to go crewless, but then he maneuvered his schedule, and I'm so fortunate that he did. So he plays the role of observing as a crew member. Bob Crowley is prepared, and he's been my training partner really these last few months for our 200s. And he brings the perspective of a new 200 runner.
Certainly, he's running Tahoe 200 in a month.
Certainly a veteran ultra runner with a lot of races under his belt. And so, Bob, you bring the perspective of new runner, if that's okay. And I bring the perspective of runner.
So you bet.
With each one of those, we're going to kind of go through some of these topics.
So I guess the first question is why even run 200 miles? And in preparation for this, I pulled out from the archives of my text messaging archive library a text conversation that I had with Don back in November 10th, 2015, to be exact, where he specifically says and took and capitalized all of the letters in this phrase where we were talking about Tahoe 200. And he says, "Let me write this down. I am not interested in 200 miles." So my question, Don, that was back in November of 2015, and now we're sitting here in August of 2017 with two belt buckles from Tahoe 200 and Bigfoot 200. What changed your mind?
Well,
why?
Scott,
why 200 miles?
I wasn't interested in 200. I was interested in 205.
Oh, okay. Right. Once you found out the races were beyond the 200 distance, you were all in.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was curiosity. You know, I think that where there's risk, there's great reward. And this was very risky for me because I had, you know, at the end of a marathon, I had a hard time getting up my foot up over a curb. And then enticed by a jacket, I ran 50 miles and then on a dare, 100 came about, and every distance seemed insurmountable, and this one had plenty of risk, and so I think that's what interested me. And Candace is a good salesman. So what about you? Go ahead, Candace.
Oh, I was gonna say I have noticed that theme of people. You know, they say, "Oh, I'm never gonna do it." It happens with hundreds too. "Oh, I'm never gonna do 100," and then somehow it just starts getting in your mind. You know, you want to push yourself past that. You know, whatever the last distance you were doing is. That's sort of what ultra running is all about, I think, at its heart. And so I hear a lot of 200 mile runners. There was a day when they said, "Nope, never." So watch out,
Bob.
Watch out, Scott.
What encouraged you to do the 200 mile distance?
I think it's a little bit of what Candace and Don have said, and probably if you know, there's the whole enlightenment and getting in touch with yourself and all that, which you say. The honest answer is, I think that these long distances give us something concrete, and you get a result. You know, you put the effort in, you do it, you get a result, you feel pretty good about that. And I think that taking whatever you've done and pushing it to another level is just the pursuit of getting another result, a better result. And so, as unexciting as that sounds, I think that's probably an honest answer for me, at least.
And there's no cheating involved in this, and any really any ultra distance.
If we find a cheater, we will run them down and drown them.
Well, I want to know, how much did Don's experience at Tahoe and his registering for Bigfoot, how much did that play into your curiosity?
I think that I knew Candace. I met Candace at Hard Rock and followed her vision to put this race together. I was very interested about that. Had always thought about doing the TRT, you know, sort of self-supported. And Marty Hoffman, Dr. Marty Hoffman, one of my training partners, had done that last year. And I thought, you know, I'm going to turn 60. Candace has put together a really exciting race. It does go around Tahoe. Would be nice to put all that together and kind of celebrate, you know, the sixth decade. So that was the primary. And then I did listen to the podcast once I had it in my head, and and that was a closer. I mean, it was really interesting to hear what Don went through. Went to some places I haven't been yet. Even though Hard Rock's a long race and it's hard, I think being on your feet another day or two in difficult conditions was intriguing to me. So definitely had an influence.
Candace, I'm interested, and I don't know, of all the time that we have known you, I don't know whether we have ever discussed what motivated you to create the first 200 race. Whatever, what made you think if you build it, they will come?
Oh man, I think it was originally just my love of Tahoe. I just got this idea in my head that there could be a race around the lake, and when I realized, I think I almost falsely thought it was permittable because it ended up being really difficult to permit. But had I known how hard it was going to be, maybe I wouldn't have even tried it. But I'm glad I did. So once I realized, looking at the maps, that I could create a really exciting route that excited me, I thought, well, why not? And then the hard part was exactly what you said. How do you know people are going to even sign up for it? Because if they don't, you can't, it's just too expensive to organize something like this. But it just so turned out, people got really excited about it. And I had enough connections with the running community that we got the word out, and we had like 180 people try to sign up that first year. Wow. Which immediately told me, okay, whew, we gotta, you know, we can make this happen. and from there, it just sort of, you know, then the 200 mile idea got into my head. But originally it wasn't to create that specific distance. It just turned into that over time, because that was the distance that the route was. And so that's sort of cool that it ends up. I really think we're going to see 200 miles become a legitimate ultra distance, just like 50 mile, 100 mile, 50K.
You know, you said something, Candace, that I think I'd like to ask Don. You said that if you knew it was going to be that difficult, you may have never even started.
Yeah.
So my question to you, Don, Bigfoot 200, in retrospect, because you've told me how much more difficult Bigfoot is than Tahoe, if you knew how hard Bigfoot was going to be, do you think you would have signed up?
Absolutely. You know, I was there for the challenge. But I'll tell you that, and Candace, I'll express to you, Miss Race Director, that the Bigfoot, much more challenging as far as elevation and difficulty, of course, but I suffered more at Tahoe because there was a lot of things I didn't know yet. I didn't know the sleep. I didn't know some of the things. So I feel like although this was tougher and required a lot of work, I didn't suffer as much. So,
do you think that's because you prepared more or prepared better for this race?
I think I had Bob as a training partner, and we worked pretty hard. And I had you as a crew, which I didn't have at Tahoe. I was just kind of out there on my own.
Do you really think that made it easier, though?
Oh, I'm going to get into that. I'm going to get into that down the road.
You still had to run 206.5 miles.
You're right. And Candace, he paced me for a very short time. I think, what, 2.5 miles, Scott?
No,
back.
It was late at night. The out that I ran was 5.5.
Yeah.
So I did 11 miles total there.
You
I'm going to check
you
it out.
You paced him until the pizza ran out.
We'll get into the pizza.
Okay, let's talk about the high points.
He never got any.
Let's talk about the high points. And I'd like to hear from Race Director. What was your high point of that event, of Bigfoot?
2017.
There were a lot. As soon as the runners start coming through the finish line, it's really exciting because you realize that the event is happening. It's going to be done because we get really tired too. And so it's exciting to see the runners you know, dreams and hopes sort of coming true. And then certainly we had this year, we had a really successful rescue mission. And that was a huge, huge plus, you know, the fact that we had spot devices on everybody. So we knew exactly where to find this person. And then I have, staff on hand who are watching the map to tell if somebody's in one place or off course for too long. So it felt like me and my my crew, we just worked together really well to make sure everybody stayed really safe the whole way. The aid stations had plenty of food, and the runners, you know, we had like a, I think 71% finish rate for such a tough race. I'm really surprised.
Hey, Candace, can you go with a bit more detail? You had a runner go off course. You used GPS tracking. Give us some details on that, if it, you know, without exposing more than should, if anything's personal.
Yeah. I won't give any names, but we had a runner who was on the second to last stretch. So he was probably around mile 190 or 185. And we were noticing his spot tracker wasn't on the course and it was just sitting in one spot. We weren't sure if it was jumping. Sometimes the signal will jump around in canyons and stuff. And so we were sort of watching to see if that was the case. When we realized he was off course and staying in one spot, we started to get worried. So we made a plan and we headed, basically headed out there. We let search and rescue know that there might be an issue, either a medical issue or a runner lost. Of course, my greatest fear is that it's a medical issue and that's why he's not moving. So we packed our bags. It was me, and I grabbed, one of our medics, Craig Longobardi. And then we had a ham radio as well. So we stayed in contact. And actually we also had a Delorme device, which, headquarters was able to track exactly where we went as we tried to find him, put the GPS coordinates in my Garmin 64 ST. And then there's just a little flag on the Garmin. You can see exactly where that person's supposed to be. And then we just hope that he doesn't move in the meantime. So we ran out, it ended up being about, 5-ish miles on the course. We ran out and then we cut down the hillside. It was really steep and super thick, like Pacific Northwest jungle kind of stuff. And we just started calling his name, trying to get voice contact. And about a mile down, but like 1,000 feet drop, so, you know, steep, we finally got voice contact. And he wasn't at that exact spot, but we just started moving toward what was an old trail bed. And we found him. It turns out he was lost, and he had the mind at that time to stay in the general area, but he was hallucinating really, really strong. He was seeing piles of burned cell phones and gang signs on the trees. And so I personally think he got lost because he wasn't fully in his right mind, but then luckily he stayed in a general area, which we would have found him anyway, but it would have taken longer. So it only took us an hour and a half to locate him, and then he was just really fatigued, but we got him back up the trail and walked all the way back.
And to Candace's credit, we actually saw her at the aid station take off up the hill to finding this lost runner. And she said she took it upon herself. She says, "I know these trails better than anybody out here. I'm going after him." And so that's to your credit, Candace. The second thing I was going to say is to the runner's credit, on these spot devices, there is an SOS button that they can press. And I think you had told us earlier that he did press that button to let people know that he was in danger.
Yeah, I think a race like this, just essential to have that type of protection, a GPS locator. Really fun for friends and family to watch you through the race on the from home, but also just runner safety, very, very important.
And I'm going to...
Let me add one last thing. He hit the SOS as we were making you always got to make a plan before you head out on a rescue mission. We were making a plan and he hit that and we're like, oh, yep, definitely need to go out. So yeah, and without a tracker on him, I don't think... It would have been nearly impossible to find him. Honestly, it would have been nearly impossible. So I think the trackers are absolutely necessary.
Yeah. If he didn't have that on, where do you start to look? Well, I mean, you go to the last aid station that he came in and say, well, we know he was there and he isn't to this one. So it could be anywhere in any direction, 360 degrees. He could have wandered any place. And how far?
Oh, yeah.
And as I recall, between those two aid stations was about a 16-mile stretch.
That's right.
So it's not a short distance. He could have got lost anywhere along that 16-mile stretch.
Yeah. We have enough runners who are either from out of the state, not used to that kind of terrain, because it is really thick. You can't tell where you are when you're deep in that forest. It's scary out there. Even like there were times when I was like, if Craig wasn't with me searching for this guy, I would be creeped out. And I don't usually get that way, but it's a deep forest in parts, and I think. Without the spot tracker, it would be, you'd have to have a bunch of people out there combing the entire area. It could take days
and
not hours.
From an entertainment standpoint, last year's Tahoe 200 was the first race that I was able to watch how well these spot trackers track the racers. And at Tahoe, where you have cell phone coverage for most of the race, it's actually really good for the crews and the pacers to keep track of where their runners are and what the ETA at the next aid station is. At Bigfoot, that did not happen. In fact, I was getting a lot of my intel from Bob, who was back in Sacramento watching on his computer. And because every once in a while I would have the ability to get a text message, Bob would send me an update and say, this is where I think Don is. And that was actually one of the ways that I was able to keep track of Don and some of the other racers. But it's actually very entertaining.
A high point for you, Scott, would be a high point from that race?
From my perspective?
From crew perspective.
From my perspective, there was a section along Coldwater Lake from that aid station. I was able to run with Don just for a short amount of time. Out and then I had to come back to get the car to get to the next aid station. And first of all, it was a high point to run with you because you were in a good place, and it was just fun to talk to you about what you'd gone through for the first, it wasn't quite half of the race.
It's just mile 46 or so.
Yeah. So you were still, you know, in good spirits and it was a fun conversation. But more than that, it was dark at night. And so when I turned back to go back to my car, I passed a lot of runners, and I was surprised every time I passed a runner. Of course, I'm stepping aside because they're the racers, right? I'm just a runner. Every single one of them, I don't think there was one person that did not say, "Hey, are you okay?" Or they thought I was a runner.
Sure.
And I had to explain, no, I'm not a runner. I'm going back to my car, and hopefully there's still a hamburger at the aid station or something like that. But I was really surprised. These runners are focused on a very selfish act of migrating 206.5 miles. But the first thing that comes to their mind when they see someone or a headlamp coming the opposite direction was, hey, is this guy okay? What can I do to help?
Yeah, a lot of camaraderie out there. Bob, what do you anticipate, either from your preparation or looking forward, what do you anticipate a high point to be?
Other than the finish.
Other than the finish. Yeah.
You know, I think there'll be three, maybe four, and that's, I'm looking forward to the sunrise. Mm-hmm. Saturday.
Sunrises.
Sunday, Monday, maybe Tuesday. Mm-hmm. But I really think, based upon my, you know, past experiences with races, long races, or training runs, it's a big deal to just get the energy. It's amazing how different it makes you feel. So, you know, resetting the clock every day as you're going along and having that natural change, I'm looking forward to that.
For me, I would say the high point was actually seeing Scott out there. It was a big deal that I hope he made it to this aid station. One, because he had some good stuff in the car, like a warm shirt or something like that. But it was very comforting.
Pillow.
A pillow. It was very comforting to see Scott standing there, and he did such a great job as a crew. I mean, at the ready. If you ever want a job as a full-time crew, people will keep you busy.
Is there a profession there?
No, there isn't. There will be after this podcast. And the thing that I probably loved most was we rented a Subaru that had seat heaters in it the front seat leaned all the way back, and that on high, this thing would really pump out a lot of heat. And I would get in that car. I'd hand Scott my stuff. He'd go fill it up, and I'd just, at night, get in this thing and turn everything up. Oh, I mean, I ran for 10 miles looking forward to that. It felt so good.
And I want to talk about that, because at the first time you slept,
yeah,
we got you on a cot, and you were right there in the aid station, and you had some earplugs that you put in.
Oh, yeah.
And you just didn't get good quality sleep. And so the next time you decided, I'm just gonna be in the car. And that was, I think, one of the surprises or one of the lessons learned that I got as a crew watching you is the best sleep that you got from that one aid station where you said, nope, I'm going to sleep in the car. We reclined the seats, turned the heat seaters on, turned the car on, turned the heater on full blast, and closed the doors, and you didn't have that outside noise disturbing you. All you had was the ambient noise of the air not the air conditioner, but the heater, and I think you got some pretty good sleep in that car.
It's hard to get out of that car because you know that you're away from the car. I have the keys. I could just drive into Washington anywhere I want.
You could have left me.
I could have left you. I just left the bib on the ground for you to finish. But my highest point, Candace, my highest point of this race was when at the finish, and the guy I ran with a lot was Terry Fletcher, and his dad was Tim, yep, who was your ally there and your colleague there as crew.
We're now brothers.
I came in and father-son embraced at the finish line,
yeah,
vocally and visually sobbing and crying because of the accomplishment. And everybody's clapping, and then all of a sudden, people realize what's going on, and they stop clapping, and there's just a reverence, a moment of just father-son embracing because the challenge has been met, and they worked as a team. And it was such a beautiful thing. That by far is the highlight of my race, watching those two embrace. And Scott took a picture of that, and I have it, not only in my mind, but it's in my phone too. And boy, that was a highlight of this race for me. Easy, easy, easy.
It was
a lot of great views, Candace, but that was the best view. That was the best view.
Which is interesting because it had nothing really to do with you.
It had everything to do with him and his accomplishment, and that's what this community is. It's about one another. So that was good. Hey, let's go to low point.
Actually, no, before that, I do want to say one of the other high points for me from a crew perspective, but it was more focused on you, was seeing you come in at the last aid station. You have 13 miles to go.
I was broken.
You were pretty tired.
Yeah.
And as such in many of the aid stations after the 100-mile mark, he came in and there was a two-part formula for you to coming back. That was eating a large sandwich or burger, real food, a whole thing. You didn't skimp on it. You weren't eating potato chips. It was real food. And the second one is just getting some good sleep or a good rest. I was impressed. After that, you got up and you ran the last 13 miles into the stadium. And I have a couple different videos of you because I stopped along the way. I was able to stop in the car and take some videos. I didn't let
you
know.
Was that legal, Candace, by the way?
What?
To stop and take pictures of him along the way.
Oh, of course.
I didn't let him in the car. I have a few pictures of him as I was pacing, as I was driving the car, and he was running alongside the car. I did not let him in, Candace.
We actually allow in this race from the last aid station to the finish, you can have as many pacers as you want.
Ah.
So it's sort of a fun way family can join.
A marching band, perhaps?
Sure.
All right. I'll work on that.
But I will say it was very impressed to watch not only how Don's speed and pace increased and that he was able to run arguably all of that last 13 miles, but in good form, good tall stance, 4-foot strike, and just ran the whole thing in. That was a high point for me to see somebody that could run for 3.5 days, 206 miles, and still have that discipline.
So let's talk about low. Who wants to lead with low? I'll lead. Anybody? However you guys want to work this.
Let's go from the runner's perspective.
The low part for me is the first 100 miles of a 200 miler, because it's just, you got to work through that first 100. I mean, it's not even game day. It is, game day starts when the bell goes, but gosh, you got to get through that first 100 to really start making it count. You need to get in the 120s and the 130s and the 140s before you can really wrap your head around this is going to get done. It's like prerequisite work. That first 100 is just, let's get it done. Let's hold together. Let's not create any damage to our body. Let's stay positive and work this first 100. So the lowest part for me was probably just the grind of 0 to 100. And there's a real high when you get over the peak and there's 100 left. It's just run to the 100 and then go to work. So that was the lowest part for me. Not any specific thing that happened, but just getting through that first group. Anybody else?
You know, I'm going to jump in there and make some observations of what I saw. You had low points. Probably the biggest low spot that I saw was at the Spencer Butte aid station. That was 102.5.
Which goes right along with what I was saying. It's better after 100.
102.5 was the only time Don questioned why he was out there and actually muttered the words, I don't want to do this.
I said that?
You said, I don't want to do this. It would be so much easier to go home and pack it in. And I reminded you, probably don't remember, but I reminded you, you had the same exact attitude coming in at Tahoe 200 at the 103.1 mark at Heavenly, where I have a picture of him eating a sandwich sitting on a ledge, and his face is just sunken. And he said, we're not made to run more than 100 miles, and I don't want to do this. I was reminded of that. The rest of the race, there was never a question on whether you would finish. There was never the thought or verbal acknowledgement that you were done or questioning your ability. Yeah. So that 102.5 mark is where I saw a low point from my perspective.
I'd be interested in other runners. You know, when you get to that 100, you're pretty well beat up because it's 100 miles and you still have 100 more to go. I think that's quite a hurdle. But once you get past it and get rolling again, I think better. Low point for you, Candace? Any low point in a race as a director, race director?
I think for me, organizing a 200 right before the race starts, like basically the Monday through the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday before is really difficult because we're organizing a bunch of supplies. There's a bunch of shopping going on. It's just a lot of stuff that hasn't been done and the race is looming. So for us, that's the hardest. You're carrying and lifting things and you haven't seen any of the runners yet. So it's once Thursday rolls around and it's all day check-in and you do the race meetings, it feels like things are settling. And then the aid stations start going out and the warehouse that we have starts getting empty. And that's when it starts to feel like, okay, like we've done what we can do and everything's going okay. And I've had a lot of breakdowns in the last week, but my new box truck broke down right after the shopping in Olympia and Crystal was driving it. And so we have all the groceries in the back and, you know, it's a 26 foot box truck. It's a ton of stuff and everything's in coolers. So it's fine. But it's just, she had to, I think the truck got fixed by a mobile repair. Like I got a call at 3 a.m. like, can I have your credit card information? And so she got back like really early that morning. And so we sort of started the week. That was Tuesday evening to into Wednesday morning. We started a little behind and just never really caught up on sleep. So that was the hardest part for me. That was the biggest low. And then we got through it and it's been nice to get some sleep.
Are you caught up on sleep yet?
No. No. It'll take a while.
Going into a race like this, you have to anticipate there are going to be lows. So Bob, as you're anticipating your Tahoe 200 in 2 weeks? 2.5 weeks? 3 weeks?
18 days.
18 days.
Have
17 days, 22 hours, 10 seconds.
Have you thought about what the low spots might look like and when they might occur?
Yeah, those spots are going to be on my feet. I think the butchering of the feet, based upon training runs this year and some of them on the course, I was telling Candace that Rubicon section is for real. I mean, that is, it's tough. And you get all that granulated, you know, just chopped up granite underneath, you know, embedded, and then you grind it all up on the granite itself and the uneven, and that's early. And then you multiply that times sweating and, you know, getting your feet wet in crossings. And I think it's the potential for your feet bringing you down is pretty high. I would be interested in Candace's own observations. So a lot of my prep in the last few weeks has really been studying how to manage your feet proactively and, frankly, how to MacGyver your feet on the move. And John Van Oof, who I know, I think you've had on, and Rebecca Rushton out of Australia have been incredibly generous with their time in trying to kind of help me put together a proactive and then race plan for the feet.
So you're talking about the physical. What about the mental low points?
Yeah.
I realize that they may be interconnected, but there's the physical downside of having blisters and pain on your feet, but then there's also the mental downside.
This is going to sound strange, but I actually look forward to those. And this is going to be loaded with them. A lot of downs. But that's the curiosity, is can you drag yourself that far down, maybe even lose control of your senses at times, like the lost runner, and still pull yourself out of it. I actually look forward to that part. It's the physical things that get in the way. They interfere with that conversation you have with your mind. And if it's on your feet, it's every step.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's every time you put your foot down. And it just, it's sort of like a break in the conversation you're having with yourself about why you need to do this and why you need to keep moving forward. And so I really do think that the physical can interfere greatly with the mental challenge, and anything we can do to proactively, you know, minimize that, whether it's training or, you know, take care of your feet or whatever, I certainly want to try to do it.
Don and I had this discussion, and he may not remember also, but I think it was after you finished. We were talking about, because he ended up with some pretty painful blisters on the bottoms of his feet. And Terry Fletcher, who he ran probably 80 miles with on and off, had an enormous challenge where he had some chafage in the groin area. And I think you were talking to him on part of the race, and do you remember the conversation?
Well, I've got to hear it first.
Okay. I may be banking this up.
I had 80 miles of conversations with the guy.
But you basically were talking to Terry, who's a tough person. And you said, you know, you finally get to the point where you say, okay, I have these blisters, I have this chafage, there's really nothing I can do about it, so just put it out of your mind and deal with it.
I get tired of listening to it, and I just said, so be it, just run with it and deal with it.
Yeah,
and that's what I did. You know, I mean, it wasn't going to stop us, and it was kind of annoying, and it hurt, sure, but I just accepted it and just ran with it.
I think that's a great transition or a great analogy to life. You know, there's some things that happen in people's lives that are bad, or you're going through a hard time in your life, and if you just say, you know, this is going to happen, I can either dwell on it and let it consume me and let it affect the rest of my life or existence, or, you know, I can just get on with my life. It's nothing I can do to make it better.
And, right? And I want to add to that. I was on a training room with Marty Hoffman not long ago, and I got upside down early in that train. It was a long run with my feet. I mean, bad. And there was a point maybe a quarter into the run where I said, Marty, my feet are hamburger helper. There's nothing good about what I'm doing to them now. And it's only about a month out, and I'm worried I'm going to
do
so much damage to them that I may not be able to recover in time. I'm thinking, you know, the best course of action is to bail for me. And then, but I said, let's go a little further. And you know, about 10 minutes later, it dawned on me, this is exactly what's going to happen in the run.
Mm-hmm.
This is precisely, you know, why you go out and train. And I need to figure out how to get this to a point where I can ignore it, I can fix it, I can MacGyver it up, and then I got to finish the other 75%. That's That's part of the sport. And when that dawned on me, exactly what you just said, Scott, it's just, you know, you suck it up, you figure it out, and it's the ingenuity in trying to figure out how to bring yourself back. That's part of the curiosity and the beauty of this wonderful race that Candace has put together, I think. That's what I anticipate.
So. Mm-hmm. Hey, sleep. You're not caught up on sleep yet in, what, 18 more days until the next one? I'm not sure if you have time to catch up yet or not, Candace. You may be pushing straight through to Christmas. Who knows? With Moab coming up. What was your sleep strategy? You know, race directors are very vital. There's always something, a question for a race director. You've got to pick your times to sleep as well. How do you manage sleep on a four-day event like this?
You know, I think it's interesting, a little bit like what you guys are talking about. You keep in mind that you're just not going to get as much as you want, and you don't make a big deal about it because nobody else is either. So I try to, you know, like you runners, it's and with your feet, it's like at some point you just accept that you're going to be tired, and then you get sleep when you can. For me, I try to get as much as I can Friday and Saturday night, but there's always things happening, or emergencies, or aid stations resupplying, things that I have to deal with. So I try to hand off. I try to have enough people at headquarters where, you know, Allie, who's working runner tracking, can let me know if it's something really important and then wake me up. So I think I got like 4 hours on Friday and 4 on Saturday and 2 on Sunday and probably 2 on Monday. Yeah. So you just sort of plan for it. And I think I'm getting better at not getting sleep. So yeah, training for it.
So so practice. Don, from your perspective, you went in, what was your sleep strategy going into the race? And is that strategy the strategy you kept for the entire race, or did it get modified?
Well, my error at Tahoe was I went too deep, where I needed 4 hours of sleep to get even again, or 5 hours. I mean, I crashed at mile 175. There was no coming out of it without being in a, you know, Michael Jackson coma for a while, and that's what I did at that aid station. So my strategy...
Michael Jackson coma? Heck does that mean?
He was induced into deep sleep through his physician. Okay. That's kind of what I needed at that time.
Never heard it that expressed that way.
It's a new phrase. Yeah. It's a new phrase.
I just kind of made it up, and if there was ever a chance to edit that, I would do it.
No, and don't. You can't. You can't edit that.
I just
that.
Leave it raw, right? Just leave it out there.
Yeah, that was good.
Sometimes.
I'm feeling you.
Sometimes when you're in front of the crowd, you trip. You just get up, dust off, and go. So this time, I slept strategically before I needed it. You know, the first 24 hours, I didn't need much. You know, maybe in retrospect, maybe I should insert a little bit more there. I think the first day, 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Or and then,
20.
And then the next day I needed more. And I started to manage differently than I did in Tahoe. I would look at what task I had in front of me. Candace, we got to talk. This 19-mile stuff that takes like 9 hours to run. I mean, no runner in their right mind would ever subscribe to, I run, but it takes me 9 hours to travel 19 miles. No way.
Yeah.
But this one, pretty good time if you can do it in 19, because there's a lot of climbing. And I
was that Lewis to Council, Lewis River to Council Bluff.
Whatever, you know, that one that had 5,400 feet of climb to it.
Oh yeah,
that one. So
well, there's two of those. But yeah,
no wonder this thing was hard.
So they're really hard. Yeah, sorry.
It was the one from Lewis River to Council Bluff.
So now as I'm looking at sleep, I was using it as you would with food, as you would with water, as if any aid. You know, it's like if I'm going to make this next 19-mile section 5,400 feet, it's really going to require a great deal of food and fluid in my pack. It's going to require an hour and a half sleep, or I'm not going to be able to pull it off. And so I learned that without pre-sleeping, without pre-loading with that sleep, you could burn an hour and a half out there just being miserable and wandering and being slow. So inject that sleep before that next long task plays dividends. Candace has a comment. Go ahead, Candace.
Yeah, it reminded me what you're saying about sleep being as important as nutrition and hydration. That is so true, because what will happen at every single one of these 200s, we'll have a few runners where it will become so bad, they should have slept sooner, where they'll lose touch with reality completely. Mm. Like, there was one woman who was hallucinating that she was in a time warp, and she was way up in the front, and she ended up throwing her poles off of a cliff because she thought that would get her out of the time warp, and we had to send somebody out to help her back. So when it is possible and even potentially dangerous to let yourself get that far, to push yourself that hard. And I don't think most of us do push ourselves that hard, but there are some people out there who will attempt these 200s and they will push themselves a little too far past that point. And that's where it becomes a little dangerous.
And here's the whole thing with that. It's just like bonking from lack of food or fluid. You don't recognize that you've gone too far until you've gone too far. And you just have to have a little bit of forecasting. You know what? This isn't possible. You have to know where that limit line is before you get there, because once you've passed it, it's too late and it catches you by surprise.
And I want to make it very clear that sleep strategy is as unique and individual as nutrition.
Right.
So there are some runners that I noticed out at Bigfoot 200 that did require more sleep. There's some that required very little sleep. There are some of those that finished at the front of the pack that, did very little sleep. But this is my observation from my point of view of Don's sleep. I would probably say that you went too far early on without enough sleep. If you would have gotten a little more sleep before that 102-mile mark, I think you would have not had that low spot. But the other observation that Don and I talked about later was how adaptable the body was. You got into a routine that if you were running, you know, between these two aid stations, which was like an 8 or 9 hour running, that you needed food, real food, a big portion of good food
before sleep.
You would eat that sandwich or that burger before you slept, and then you got at least an hour, sometimes an hour and a half, and sometimes pushing 2 hours, depending on what your body was saying. But if you could get the food and you could get that hour to hour and a half sleep, you were a new man. And it was neat how your body adapted in such a short amount of time to say, this is what my new routine is. I get an hour and a half of sleep. I get an hour and a half of sleep, and then I run for 9 hours.
Right.
Then I get something to eat.
It was a rhythm.
Then I get an hour and a half of sleep.
It was a new rhythm.
Yep. And it was really amazing that how your body adapted to that and responded positively to that new routine.
Bob, what's your sleep strategy going into Tahoe?
Yeah, it's actually the number one thing when I signed up. I started to think about it right away. It was, this is going to be completely new. I don't know anything about it. I don't really have any idea how my body's going to react to it. So have incorporated practicing sleep, just like eating and the distance and the mental preparation, into the training. And we've gone out a number of times and tried just about every part that you mentioned. The lay down by the side of the trail when there's a nice grassy area and just put your pack under your head and try to get 20 minutes routine. We've done the let's sit for a couple of hours and see if we can get a more solid sleep. Let's sleep when it makes sense, like it's dark or you're tired. Let's sleep on a schedule. Nothing's worked. Honestly, I mean, we have had modest success. So I think my strategy is going to be program it, just as you've said. And I've got very specific spots that I want to look forward to sleep. And that'll be, you know, it's the three F's, right? You get in there and you feed yourself, you fix whatever needs fixing, and you flop. And just, you know, hit it and get enough sleep. And then get back up and back into the rhythm. And view it, maybe if I do that three times, then it's, you know, it's three routines, it's three cycles over the 200 miles. Maybe it's four, it just depends. But I think if I program it, then I'll discipline myself to do it. If I let myself wander about and say I'll do it when I feel like it or whatever, I'm pretty convinced I'll just stumble myself into a stupor. And then I think it based upon everyone I've spoken to, it's pretty tough to come back.
I was at mile 170 or so with Terry that we were running with, and I was following him, and he started to wander like he had been sneaking a drink of Jack Daniels for the last hour and a half, and just kind of stumbling, and he just turns around and he says, "I'm going to sleep. I'm setting my alarm for 8 minutes." And I said, "Me too?" And he just kind of kicked a piece of rock out of the way, and next thing you know, we were down on the ground as using my poles as a pillow, and we had the best sleep for 8 minutes, and we got up and soldiered on. But sometimes you can have strategies, and sometimes you just need to pull a ripcord and say, we're down for eight, and we're going to get back up and go. And it was a really good recharge, yeah, too.
Just to that, Marty and I went, you know, on the course. I think we almost, it was almost a 100-mile training run, not completely on the course, but we were between Loon Lake and Wright's, and we had not slept. So we were going on our second night, and little to no sleep. And we went to that strategy and said, you know, every hour on the 50, let's stop. And let's take 10 minutes. Just sit, eat, drink, make sure we're, you know, just sit. We're not sleeping, but we're resting. And because we programmed it, you know, 50 minutes wasn't nearly as bad, because it was a long night, and it's that huge, you know, long climb all the way to the Jeep Road and then down to Wright's Lake. So it's a long pull. And at night, you don't know where you're going and you're wandering around. And so I think breaking it down into smaller bits, but being aware, just like when you're hungry or you're thirsty, you got to eat and drink. I think when you're sleepy, there's no shame in saying, I'm going to stop and sit down and take 10.
You know, the one thing that I would, and again, it's all individual, but from me observing Don did bring earplugs. Earplugs for him, either he didn't get them in correctly or they were ineffective.
Or I didn't know where my ear was.
He put them up his nose. I think that was a critical component for him. So if he had some noise-canceling headphones, which I know you have them in your ears right now, I think that maybe that would have been a benefit if we didn't have the car to sleep in.
Surprises. Any surprises out there? Candace Burt, any surprises as race director? Do you get at least one surprise every race, or are you this old hat for you and you've seen it all?
Yeah, it's definitely still getting surprises, but I'm also noticing certain things that seem to happen over and over again that you just get used to. I'm trying to think of any surprises at Bigfoot. Maybe come back to me and
I'll back to you. And yeah. I'll tell you my biggest surprise. Are you ready?
Yep. Ready.
What's up with no switchbacks? You know, every single hill is like straight up or straight down. And I said that in front of a group, and Howie Stern that was out there, a great photographer, that's Candace's photographers out there, said, well, the PCT trail and many of the trails that you have out in your country were built for pack animals, and they were built for transporting materials and supplies, and those pack animals need switchbacks. I just want to tell Howie that I'm a pack animal and I need some switchbacks, because brother, going straight up a hill is hard work. thank goodness I had a pole. That was my biggest surprise. I didn't find too many switchbacks out there on your Cascade mountain range.
There, you just grind straight up the hillside.
Straight up the hill.
Yeah. And that's the unique thing about Bigfoot. Actually, Katra Corbett told me, she ended up dropping, but she was like, these aren't like the trails in California.
No.
They're steep.
Let me tell you another surprise, is Candace has some mandatory out and backs. Because, without those out and backs, we could have had an even 200, just so you know. So this 206 is for her out and backs. And she takes us up to share with us these views, these beautiful, most magnificent, I'm sure, views on the planet.
Yeah.
But I hit two of those three at night, which means no view. Except for the sign that says, turn around here. And she draws pictures of the mountains where they're located. So I know that they're located out there. But my only view was really her drawings on these signs.
And one of the funny things about that is Don's showing me these photos of the sign that says, turn around here. I go, what did you take a picture of that for? And he says, so I have proof that I actually made it out here and back. And I go, Don, they're tracking you with your GPS. They know if you've made it. He goes, oh, okay.
I was going to send it to Candace and say, look, and I did it, doggone it. You think of things like that when you're out there. Biggest surprise, anticipated surprise, Bob? You're going to be surprised, right?
I mean, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I can't...
How do you predict a surprise?
I think there'll be plenty of them. Plenty.
Candace, you had time to think about it?
Yeah, I guess I... man, from a race director point of view, I think the one thing that actually comes to mind is each year with, you know, the participants we have, I get to know them. I'm excited for their runs and I follow them. And, you know, throughout the year, you get questions, you get to, they feel like part of that, the Bigfoot family or the Tahoe family. And each year it just feels like the next year just isn't going to be the same. It's not going to be that family. But yet over the course of the year, by the time the end of the race comes around, you know, you're going to miss those people till the next year, or maybe they'll do a different 200. But yeah, I think it's always a surprise to me how cohesive and community feeling comes out of each event, even with, you know, maybe 70% of the people being brand new to it. It's pretty cool.
Huh. Yeah.
So I have a lot of surprises. If you don't mind me chirping in here.
No.
Okay, so here are the big surprises from a crew standpoint. I didn't crew Don last year for the whole Tahoe 200. I went up and saw him a couple times, but at Tahoe 200 you have cell phone coverage. Mm-hmm. And you can track him on the live tracking. I was surprised when I got up to Bigfoot that 95% of the time you have no access to any Wi-Fi or cell phone coverage. You are black, which in turn surprised me because it was very, very difficult to get from one aid station to the next. Even though there were turn-by-turn directions that were given to the crew, some of those things were altered a little bit, and it took just a really, really long time. I was also expecting that I could get to nearby towns. On Tahoe 200, you can hit a town in between aid stations, no problem. On this course, I mean, there was probably two and a half days where I wasn't able to get to a town. So I was worried about fuel. I was worried I was going to run out of gas. I thought I got lost a few times. So there are some interesting... challenges there, or surprises that I had, which tie into what am I going to do differently, but we'll get into that in a minute.
And I want to say, Candace, the course was perfectly marked. Not a single time did I question. I never had to turn on my phone to look to see where I was located. Am I on course or not on course? It's just very intuitive. When there was any turn or any question, I'd look up, especially at night with those dragons that you have with reflective tape, and you beam out there with your high beam Petzl lamp or whatever you're using, you can see where you're going out a mile if you're within sight. So
it's open. Yeah.
Really well marked.
Was not marked as well for crew.
No.
The driving directions.
Well, I wanted to make a note about crew too. Bigfoot is so hard to crew, and you know, kudos to all you guys who crewed it, because I mean I don't know if you kept track of how many miles you have to drive, but I think it's like 400 and something to crew the whole.
Our rental car, we put 2500 miles on.
We did not. 2500?
Yeah.
No, we got to recheck that. It started with 7500.
You are delirious.
I think it's more like 1500.
Well, it's a lot of driving. And so when we have to resupply aid stations too, it's always like an aid station will call in, you know, we're out of paper towels. We're like, well, you know, good luck.
Use your shirt.
Yeah, we're not driving things 3 hours out to give you paper towels. But generally, yeah, we have to do a lot of those trips. They'll just be random things, or maybe somebody's stove will stop working, and then we'll have to drive a stove out. But we'll have probably five different people driving 2 or 3 hours one way just to get supplies out. Crew really go through a lot to crew their runner on this.
They sure do.
There were some aid stations. It took me 3.5, almost 4 hours to get from one aid station to that other. Now, I don't want to.
It took me 9.
I know. I don't want to throw down in front of the guy that had to run that far. But
right.
Wait, you're telling me you sat in an air-conditioned car with your favorite tunes
no,
playing?
No, I turned the heater on so that I could be empathetic.
I appreciate that. Okay. Hey, biggest surprises we did. How about what would you do different? What would you do different as a crew, Scott? What would you do?
Okay, so I have
different?
A long. I have a very long list. One is preparation. I didn't have a good map. I should have had a good map. I was thinking I have a GPS. I have a GPS in my watch. I have a GPS, a handheld GPS. I had a ham radio with me, but I didn't have a map. I will say, anybody that's considering running any of Candace's races, absolute requirement, you have to download the app, the Jaya?
Or similar, yeah.
Whatever, that app, because the course is on there, and it does not require you to have cell phone coverage. You can find out exactly where you are. I was with other crew that had good maps, but they couldn't tell where they were on the map. And so I think
that's a good point.
Good map. Have to have a very good map.
Let me just interject on that too, because when Marty and I went out, of course, the course isn't marked, and some of it isn't cleared yet. They just haven't, you know, the people that take care of that with Candace hadn't been out yet. So some of it's overgrown, a lot of trees down. So we had to navigate, and we went to the app multiple times, and it works fantastic, Candace.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, it really is a lifesaver, because we were wandering around. At first, we thought it was cheating, so we didn't use it. And then we're like, how stupid are we? It is, I mean, the little blue dot, you know, it's like, Marty, go 20 paces to the east. He walks. I said, look down. You're going to see the trail. And he looks, and he goes, son of a gun. It's that good.
You could probably run that race without any markings. Don't even think about it, Candace. Yeah. You could probably navigate just with that.
It could be done.
And I will tell you that
it would take longer.
Yes,
a lot
it would.
Longer.
That's good to hear, because it took us forever.
and very frustrating. It's great to have the markings out there.
I like Candace. I have a very nice handheld GPS, the Garmin 64ST. It's a very good GPS handheld. And I would almost argue that this app it's definitely easier to use, and it may be just as accurate as the handheld Garmin. Hmm. So that's one. The other one is Don and I did very little communication and planning for this. So I had no idea how many drop bags he had. I didn't know what was in the drop bags. I didn't know, you know, what his plan was. And this is Crew 101, right? Stuff that we should have talked about.
Don,
that we
the Imelda Marcos drop bags.
I really didn't know what was in the drop bags.
Scott. What kind of timing, you know, the timing expectations. I really didn't know what your sleep strategy was. Making sure that his devices were charged, his GPS watch, his iPhone, and stuff like that. One of the things that I also would change, we figured out probably within the first 50 miles, is we changed, first of all, we have the same GPS watch. He said that his watch wasn't working, which I think was a little bit of loony on his side. But I took my watch off, gave him my watch.
Like customers, the runner is always correct.
Right.
Go ahead.
But the one thing that we found that was invaluable for him was we changed the settings on the watch. So he had two pieces of information that were at his disposal. One was altitude, and the other one was mileage.
Yeah.
And we found that was very valuable, because he would know approximately what the maximum altitude was of that section, and that was a good cue for him that he could reach to the top of that and go, okay, I now know that I'm at the top, even if it was late at night.
Yeah, that was the key, Candace, because if it was late at night, there's no way of knowing whether you're at the top, because you can't see. It's just stars and dark. And so when I hit, say, 5,500 feet, I knew by the profile that was my high point. Yep. So I knew where my mileage and my high point. I knew I was done climbing. But poor Terry that I was with.
This is a great story.
I would yell out, there's 5,300. And I just on a regular basis, I would report the altitude to him. And at the end of the race, the next day, he goes, I was kind of wondering why you were telling me all those numbers.
He had no idea what numbers he was calling out.
He didn't even have any idea why I was saying these things. I guess we didn't have time to talk about it.
Being the nice guy that he was, he never said anything to you like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
What do those numbers mean? He just kind of conserved his energy and his spoken word to just ignoring him.
The next day he said, at least I know where 5,500 feet is now. Okay, what would you do different? Me, I would change. I would not start out at Tahoe. I'm an ultra shoe wearing guy.
Ultra. Yeah.
And I started out with the Superiors last time, which is more their minimalist shoe. And this time I thought I'll be a little bit smarter and start in the Lone Peak instead, kind of a mid cushion, and then move my way up to the Max cushion. Now I would start with maximum cushion from step one and just stay that way. I may change in a couple different pairs of shoes to freshen it up, but definitely I would start maximum cushion from the start.
Along that same line, I will tell you, big mistake was we didn't have enough socks.
Six was not enough.
You need to have socks in every single drop bag. Your crew needs to have a half a dozen pairs of socks. That was the one issue. There are a couple times where you needed to change out socks, and one time we had to use an old pair of socks that I finally got dried out, but they were still old and stinky.
There was a lot of silt and water crossings.
You can never have too many pairs of socks.
And I think a good idea is just to rip those off and get rid of the silt and the little fine particles and freshen up.
Along that same line, Don, let's talk about compression calf sleeves. Do you think that you would have more of those?
I just put them on for warmth.
Okay. Yeah. So, but you wore them a lot more than you normally do training.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I hardly don't wear them ever training, but I enjoyed
wearing
them. In fact,
I don't know if you remember, I took a pair of tights and cut the bottoms of those off.
Now,
so he would have a pair of leg warmers.
Now that's a crew. Now that is a dedicated crew. He actually cut a pair of his own full-size tights so I could have a pair of leg warmers.
By the way, you still have a pair of my shorts, too. He didn't have enough pair of shorts. We changed out shorts a few times.
Yeah, well, they were in drop bags that we didn't know were.
That's another thing. I didn't know it was in your drop bags.
Here's the story about Scott. He goes, okay, I'm completely organized now. I've taken everything out, and I've placed everything, and I've accounted for every item you have. And I'd ask him for an item, and he goes, except that one. I don't know where that one is.
And inevitably, every single time he asked me for, I had everything. All of my time was spent trying to take, first of all, Subaru, great vehicle, not enough room. If I was to do it again, I would get a bigger vehicle because you need to spread this out. I mean, I had the trunk and the back seat just littered with stuff. And I thought that I had everything kind of strategically. And he would say, there were two things specifically. One time he said, where are my Njinji compression socks? I said, Don, we don't have Njinji compression socks. He goes, yes, they are. They're in the orange bag. I go, no, they're not in the orange bag. We found out they were in a drop bag at a future aid station. The other one was some caffeine pills that Bob gave Don. Where are the caffeine pills? I go, they're in your shorts. He goes, no, they're not in my shorts. I go, yes, they are. That's where we put them in the last aid station. He goes, they're not in here. We looked in his shorts. They're not in there. I searched forever to find those. Finally, between one aid station, I was in a town and I pulled everything out in a parking lot and spread it out in the parking lot. I found the caffeine pills.
Where?
Don took them out before he went to sleep and he put them in a small cubby hole in the back seat of the car.
Oh no.
But it was good because that's what you used the last aid station to get you in.
So, Candace, Bert, is the 200 the new 100-mile run? You have a hat that says that. You stand by that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a little deceptive because it's nothing like a 100-miler, but I think what we mean by that is that I think it's a new goal for people who have been doing hundreds, whereas when you're doing ultras, you know, your goal is to finish 100 or to do like all these different hundreds that you have your eye on. So I think as we create more 200-mile races that are goal races, not just loop kind of training run stuff or timed stuff, that more people want to be motivated to go out and try like a really cool new course. Adventure.
And if anybody is considering this, I would highly recommend volunteering. There are three races that Candace has right now in different parts of the country, up in Oregon, here in California, over in Utah. Go and volunteer as a aid station worker or a medic or a crew or a pacer, and go and experience the what is a 200, because it's very, very different than a 100. I got to know in the course of the 4 days some of the crew and pacers that were on at Tahoe 200. I got to know Tim Fletcher very, very well. I got to know a bunch of these people. And, you know, you may get to know people on a 100-miler, but when you spend 4 days with them going from aid station to aid station and seeing the challenges that they go through, it's amazing.
And it's not just 200 miles. It's 200 miles of elevation change of 50,000 up and 40,000 down. I mean, Terry and I said as we were running out there, there's no way to communicate this with anybody what we're doing when it takes 9 hours to run 19 miles. You really have to see it and experience going straight up some of these things and dancing through lava rocks in the beginning and climbing up ropes through a big drainage culvert to try to get up and all of these things that this race has to it. It's as much as an adventure as it is running 2 miles an hour is actually a pretty good time, you know, and to do that on the track is almost ridiculous. But when you're out there, you are working hard to get that stuff done. Candace, you put together one heck of a race and, amazing that they're both uniquely different, super challenging. If you've done one, you haven't done the other one. That's for sure. And I'm a little bit different. I'm really a little bit worried about Moab because it might be calling me a little bit now. I don't know.
Mark his words, a week after Bigfoot, he's already considering.
Oh, yeah, I bet. It's interesting because I can't tell you how many people after the Bigfoot, they just had such a great experience, even though like literally right after they're like, yeah, never again. But, you know, then I'm getting emails like sort of thinking about doing the triple this year, even though Tahoe's 3 weeks away. I had a couple of people do that. I was like, that's awesome. You know, you should go for it.
How many people do you have doing the triple? Because there's more than I thought.
I think there's like 21.
Yeah.
21 people.
And I want to say something else that I was surprised. So there are runners out there that are being crewed by a team of NASA engineers. I mean, they have these big motorhomes full of five or six crew, six pacers, and just an enormous a team effort. And then I was surprised how many are out there doing it with no support.
Like
no
yeah.
crew,
like Mika.
No
she
pacer.
Ran right around us. Mika was an independent
and
soul.
Richard. Remember Richard?
Yeah.
Richard was doing it on his own too. And you know, just relying on the planning of strategically placed and planned drop bags and relying on the generosity and humanity of the aid station workers. So it can be done. It has been done.
And what's unique about the 200-mile distance is if you team up with somebody and you're working with them and they're a co-runner.
In fact, we need to get into that just as we're ending this. I know we're running out of town.
Maybe I was, Scott.
Let's talk about you and Terry.
Okay.
You guys met at Tahoe last year and ran how many miles together-ish?
A bunch.
A bunch of miles.
Yeah.
You guys both kind of became friends, challenged each other to run Bigfoot, had no intention or expectation of running Bigfoot together. But how many miles did you run
together?
Probably
80 miles. We didn't start off. We just kind of just met up coincidentally, and our timing was right, and we just kept running together. I was going to say, I forgot my thought.
Mine was better.
Yeah, it was.
My story was much better.
So
I just thought it was neat that you just kind of fell into the same rhythm as Terry and ended up, he needed the same amount of sleep as you did. He was running the same pace as you were, and it just kind of it was fun to watch that synergy.
And when you're with somebody like that, or with your core group, your five or six that you kind of trade places with throughout the race, what I like about the 200 mile distance, guys, is that usually you run into an aid station, you swoop in, you swoop out. You know, if you can get it in and out in 2 minutes, you know, you're hammering it, you're doing a great job. In this one, you take your time, you sit down, you get your stuff. And if the person you're running with says, I need 10 more minutes, you go, yeah, me too. I'll wait for you. And there's no real rush. You know, there's no real, I got to get going. You don't have that sensation of needing to go. So I really like that part.
You know, I also want to just throw in some kudos for one of the pacers. Darren, I think was his name. He started pacing one of the runners that was with Don's group, Dustin. I can't remember Dustin's last name. But he ended up finishing in a great time. Darren ended up running like 80 or 90 miles, pacing
110.
Was it 110? You know, just pacing different people. And by the way, at every aid station, he drank a Rainier beer. And the whole time he was smiling. I just thought that was amazing. Here's a pacer that ended up running 110 miles. Didn't plan on it. but just was out there having a ball and drinking beer and having a good old time.
So Bob Crowley, we're going to wish you the very, very best at Tahoe. We'll be out there with you in spirit, but also physically too. I'm going to show up and witness your great achievement, because we trained way too many miles together for me not to take a look and see how you're doing.
Well, I'll be honest. I'm privileged to have you guys. I am really excited. I am also scared itfless.
Yeah.
And
that's healthy. I think that's healthy.
And that's good. I mean, it's nice to have that sensation, that anxiety. That's living. That's living right there.
Candace, thanks for creating the 200. We're going to say you created them. You've created some races with personality that like to fight back. And it was a privilege to be up there and to meet all the great personalities and runners and crew and pacers and aid station workers. You put together an amazing race with an amazing team.
And you've got guys like me that feel satisfied, and you've got guys like Bob, countless, that are just nervous. You're affecting a lot of people in a lot of ways, and that's very, very cool. That's what life's about, affecting one another.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. Thanks for the kind words, guys. Tahoe coming up, 200 runners, so it'll be the biggest 200 yet, and Bigfoot had 110 people start, so we're getting up there in numbers. I think 200 might sort of be our max, just so we can make sure there's enough food on course, and because transportation at some point becomes a major issue in terms of supplies. So yeah, I'm super excited to see how it goes, and we're working hard. I'm putting in like 16-hour days on the computer right now just to get everything done.
And it's not too late if you're interested to register.
That's
for
right.
Moab. Moab still has openings, and it's coming up on what dates, Candace?
It's the 13th through the 17th of October. And actually, while we're at it, you could still sign up for Tahoe.
Oh, okay.
Registration closes September 1st. So, a few more people would be great. Sign up, get in on the biggest 200 yet. History, we're making history.
and I think there's some 2018 Bigfoots available at this still. Is that right, Candace? You can still get into 2018 Bigfoot?
Well, we're going to, we always do this special thing, and it started after the first year where we opened registration pretty quickly, but we have, it's like $200 off the regular price. So it's a lot cheaper. And then people who are in the know, you know, who've run it, can sign up and get a really good deal. And so that'll open August 24th. So I'm working on that too, doing all the runner's manual changes. But for anybody wanting to run Bigfoot, that's a good, it's definitely a good time to sign up. Then you'll be committed all year, training hard. And Bigfoot's sort of like, I don't know. What do you think, Don? I mean, it's pretty unique.
If you haven't run up there, you've got to go. I mean, just
it's amazing.
The views.
I didn't know it ran around Mount St. Helens.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Just you probably didn't get able to, you weren't able to see Mount St. Helens because you were having your eyes on the trail, but that's an amazing mountain up there. And Mount Adams, oh my gosh, beautiful.
Yeah.
So beautiful. Yep. Yeah.
Definitely a must do. If you're an ultra runner, you've got to put your name down on that.
The Bigfoot 200 is probably currently the staff favorite, but then again, a lot of them haven't. This will be the first Moab 200, so maybe that'll change. We'll see. We'll see.
So go out and sign up and run
200.
Moss.
Hey,
thanks,
Candace,
that was good.
Thank you very much. And I think a good way to get people off the fence if they're thinking about a 200. I think this was a fun discussion.
It was, yeah. I could talk about 200s all day.
You do.
How about for 4.5?
Oh, yeah, I do that too.
Okay.
I'm really, really excited to have you out too, Bob.
Hey, can't wait. I can't believe it's 18 days. It seems like forever, but I'm really psyched.
He's chomping at the bit.
What you've done, remarkable. Being a race director, knowing what you've been through, knowing that area and how hard it is to permit and how hard it is to carve those courses out. Absolutely stunning, remarkable job. I got to tell you, can't wait.
So there's still some spots, huh? There's still some spots, huh, Candace?
Yeah, because I...
there goes my number 77. There it goes.
I think, Don, I think you might want to do the triple this year.
Yeah, I think he might too.
Your feet are doing. Your feet are working better. You're recording this?
No, I am recording it. I'm going to go out and do some course marking with you. I've got those days scheduled, so we'll see what's left to me after that.
No, I'll give you the 77. You got to take it.
77 is my number, Candace. You know that, right?
Well, I'm going to actually send the email out for people to pick their numbers today or tomorrow, so you better sign up soon.
See, Don?
Don.
Because...
Ouch. I'll save the number for you for another week. How about that?
Okay, that sounds good.
Yeah, and I'm going to take it from him if he doesn't go, but he's going to go. Yeah. He's cracking already. I can see him.
All right, Cannon. We'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Yeah. Oh, Bob?
Yeah.
Are you still there? You have any aid station requests?
Gee whiz. I like savory food.
We didn't even talk about the pizza.
Yeah, so like anything savory, burritos, pizzas, quesadillas, all that stuff. I'm sure you have all that.
It's the best. It's the best food ever.
And you guys have Tailwind, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's awesome.
Oh. A bunch. Yeah, we're getting even more for Tahoe since we have so many more runners. But yeah, that was a really exciting sponsorship to get this year.
They're great.
They're giving it all to us for free, which is amazing for us.
We did that back at the Trail Animals. They're wonderful people. I'm planning on putting 5 pounds on this race.
Oh, I didn't lose any weight. I did not lose any weight. Best food ever.
Yeah.
Nice.
And I stashed some beer, a case of beer with the Jeep guys. For sure. No, he did.
Oh, yeah.
You're not going to drink beer in the middle of a race.
Oh, that's not the middle. That's the beginning. Get dusty out there.
Beer's good in a 200 miler.
Yeah.
A little bit.
All right. Take care. We'll see you in a few weeks.
Thank you. Bye. Thanks for having me. Okay, bye.